Hello and welcome to the Majlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. I know we all, in fact, the whole world is discussing the crisis in Ukraine these days and what Russian President Vladimir Putin might have in mind for this country's future going forward. But as we speak, Russian tanks are roaming all around Ukraine. The Air Force is pinpointing and destroying targets in the face of all this. Ukraine, one of the most developed and populated former Soviet republics, seems to be helpless and at the mercy of President Putin. Having already annexed Crimea to the Russian territory, Putin this week declared two Ukrainian regions independent, and the context in which he did this announcement has created shock waves throughout the region. This couldn't be felt more in countries in the backyard of Russia, in Central Asia. Authorities in Central Asia are silent, but are concerned and perhaps scared about what all this tension could mean for them, politically and economically, in the short and the long term. On the economy, any shock in the Russian financial markets will be devastating for them. Their economies are extremely dependent on Russia, and some of them are part of the Russia-led Eurasia Economic Union. On the political side, Russia's recognition of Luhansk and Donbass independent, and it is possible plans for Ukraine's future can create even bigger political hurdles, especially the context in which Russia drags the whole region into its adventures in this or the other way. This could come as a result of direct political pressure or within the umbrella of CIS or CSTO. So there is a lot to talk about, and today we are here just to do that. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Dr. Paul Stronsky, Senior Fellow in Carnegie Endowment's Russia and Eurasia Program, Dr. Erica Marat, Associate Professor at the National Defense University, Alisher Sadiq, the Director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek Service, locally known as Ozotlik, and Bruce Panier, the Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So let's start with sort of your general observation of how Central Asia has been reacting so far or discussing the situation surrounding Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Perhaps we can start with you, Alisher, what you have been hearing.
Yeah, as you pointed out, officially nothing has been said in general even. So they keep silence. The only quote that was circulating since recently was a quote of President Mirziyoyev, you know, the statement which he made under unknown circumstances in province of Karakalpakstan. So he's basically said we need to improve our economy and our defense. So very vague, but something. So officials are very silent, and they are preparing kind of only for evacuation of Uzbek citizens in Ukraine. They stopped flights between Ukraine and Uzbekistan. So, but in general, the public is very concerned, very interested. You cannot imagine even. So everyone is like really scared, concerned. Though Uzbek officials are not saying anything, intellectuals, journalists, bloggers, they're absolutely free to say many, many things about Putin these days, you know, with the very unpleasant words for
what they are talking about.
You know, all these things like crazy guy, stuff like that. So
anything on the policy level,
you will find who would support him. There is a big group of people, we call them people who are completely, let's say, consumed by zombie box. This is how Russian television is called. So these guys, they say, Putin was right, blah, blah, this stuff like that. But as you also pointed out very well, the looming economic ramifications would also change their mind. That's what we believe.
I guess we are going to talk about that in a bit. Also, Erica, let me also bring you in here. You know, speaking of the mood on the streets, I have seen a few protests taking place here and there in Kyrgyzstan and in Kazakhstan. I guess they are sort of expected, right?
Yes, they are expected, but I have to say that they're not really big protests. And in Kazakhstan, especially, they were quickly dispersed by the police. And we know that Oyan Kazakhstan organized a small demonstration. I would also want to add that even though what we see on social media, especially on Twitter and Facebook, is condemnation of Putin and then siding with Ukraine, feeling the pain that Ukrainians are going through right now, I think Russian propaganda still has power in Central Asia. And I hear a lot of from the public that there's quite a large part of the public in Central Asia that support Putin's actions, and maybe not necessarily brutality that is currently unfolding in Ukraine, but the general premise has the right.
That's what I was thinking about. What exactly they support, Rika?
The general premise of Putin that Ukraine is ruled by Nazi or whatever else extremist regime of, you know, the falsehoods perpetrated by Russian media and Kremlin. And then in a broader scale, that Soviet Union was a good thing and needs to be restored. And Putin is doing a good thing by restoring a Soviet Union. So I'm not saying, it's hard to say how much of the public shares these beliefs, but we can't ignore that there are people who do in Central Asia still today.
Those opinions also exist there. Yeah, I was also watching our Tajik service Vox Pop with local experts. Obviously, their concern is driven by kitchen and butter issues, like if Russia is sanctioned, there will be, you know, fewer jobs for migrant workers, and that the whole tension is very close to home. So I guess they are right. They have seen this movie repeating in limited version after Russia's invasion of Crimea, and we are going to talk about that. But just want to throw that. So, Paul, when you look into Central Asia, what is your reading in terms of their reaction or lack thereof?
Well, I think, you know, thus far, I think, surprisingly, I would think the most vocal reaction I've heard is from the Kazakh foreign minister, where he pretty much indicated that they were not going to follow, you know, Russia's lead in recognizing Donetsk and Luhansk. Those were the two the most bold statements out there. And I thought it was kind of interesting, given that the Kazakh government is so now dependent and has some chips it needs to pay back to Putin, that I think that was certainly notable. I would also agree with Erica. I mean, I think from what I'm hearing, you know, whether it's the Nazis, whether it's the collapse of the Soviet Union, these allegations of neo-Nazism, which is false, whether it's the, you know, lamenting the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also this belief that Ukraine is controlled by the West and this entire thing was orchestrated by the West instead of by Russia, I think that narrative is certainly there. But I do think, you know, this is very worrying for these states. If you look at, you know, the language that Putin used to deny Ukrainian history and deny, you know, he's denying the Ukrainian people the right to elect their governance, denying the Ukrainian people, you know, the right to have their own history and their own state. Some of that same language, you know, could certainly be, we've heard before in places like Kazakhstan. That's probably why the Kazakhs came out and said what they said. And I think, you know, there's also been, you know, Russian mucking around in other places throughout the region as well, and potentially stoking or fears that they could stoke problems. I found it interesting that Mirziyoyev said all of that in Karakol, Pakistan as well. So I think, you know, a lot of these countries, they're nervous. They're trying to keep their heads down. They recognize the implications this could have for them, particularly, you know, when, you know, he's Putin has been sort of talking about, you know, wanting to sort of reestablish some sort of a Soviet core. And so I think, you know, they're trying to keep their heads down. They're trying not to upset Russia, but they're going to have a huge amount of problems on their hand moving forward. I would say, you know, the biggest ones is going to be economics. You know, it's not just the migrant issue, but also, you know, as more and more Russian banks are getting sanctioned, many of these companies throughout the region do their transactions through many of these banks. And so they're going to have a lot of problems, you know, moving forward doing international transactions, and where are they going to continue to work through those banks or risk breaking the sanctions? And then, you know, we're going to see, you know, whole fluctuations right now in commodity prices. Grain is certainly going to be affected. Oil and gas are certainly going to be affected.
No, I'm happy that you started talking about that, Paul. So I realized that we have an expert to go into details of what all these sanctions might mean for Central Asia. And definitely we are going to talk about this in length. But before that, Bruce, your thoughts, like kind of a general observation of the way Central Asia is reacting, authorities, expert community and locals, the way they are reacting or what they are saying and what they are not saying. What's your interpretation of that?
Like we've heard, people are trying to, except for a few protests, people are trying to keep a low profile on this one. It's kind of hard to say what media they would use to express their opinions on some of this stuff. You know, there's social media, and I watch that. And some people are from Central Asia are clearly horrified by what's happening in Ukraine, you know. But I think, you know, with something like that Paul touched on a minute ago is probably on the minds of all of them, is that when Putin starts talking about historical lands, that includes Central Asia, of course, you know, and this has got to be something that people are thinking about, you know, that he could make the same claim that Russia has occupied Central Asia since the 19th century, you know, in different parts of it. You know, and then of course that, you know, Ali Shir brought up that Mirziyoyev made his comments when he went to Karakalpakstan. It's strange because of course we know that Karakalpakstan wants greater autonomy and even independence from Uzbekistan, some people there. So, you know, that's another thing that Putin brought up. Recognition of separatist regions is something that also makes a lot of, and not just government officials, but regular people uncomfortable in Central Asia. They've gotten used to looking at the map and seeing where their countries are, you know, and you start legitimizing separatism if it's backed by a great power. You know, where exactly is this in? We like I said, we just did the show on Gorno-Badakhshan a while ago. Yeah. You know, and so there's pockets all over Central Asia where you can make a case that, yeah, that people would, you know, if you're going to loosely define separatist regions and, you know, as areas that are potentially recognizable by major governments, you know, it opens up a whole can of worms that a lot of people don't want to see opened, I suppose.
Yeah, there's also no end to that when you look into Central Asian map. So obviously there are expert communities. Earlier was also referring to some of them really, really concerned about the possible economic and political implications of all this to the region. I was hoping to dive into this in a second half of the conversation. Again, the genuine fear that the region's economy is so much intertwined with those of Russia, if there was to be a shock in the Russian financial market, especially in the context of severe sanctions that the Western countries are talking about, they are worried about their implications in the region. Also, the political implications of all this to the region, a couple of you already hinted that, given Putin declared to Ukrainian regions independent and sent troops there as peacekeepers. The context in which he also made his announcement is sort of sent chilling waves, so many former Soviet republics, as Bruce was just talking about. So let's continue the conversation by talking about some of the yet to be seen implications of the ongoing crisis to Central Asia and how they are preparing for this. Before that, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Paul Stronsky, Senior Fellow in Carnegie Endowment's Russia and Eurasia program, Dr. Erika Marat, Associate Professor at the National Defense University, Alisher Siddiq, the Director of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Uzbek Service, and Bruce Panier, the Editor of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the Central Asian perspective on Russian-Ukrainian crisis and what this could mean for the region. So, you know, a couple of you already brought up this. I wish we could have unpacked this earlier, the statement that President Putin made about Ukraine as a whole when declaring so-called Luhansk and Donbas republics independent. You know, Kamaluddin Rabimov, political expert, I'm sure some of you know him, and speaking to our Kazakh service, this is how he interpreted the speech. And I'm quoting him. He says, Putin believes that he cannot declare war on everyone at the same time. However, by declaring Luhansk and Donbas independent, Putin made it clear that he would continue gathering Russian lands. And he goes on, the main thesis of Putin's speech on Monday was that in the Soviet years, territories belonging to Russia were unfairly transferred to other Union republics. In the last 2 years, he often mentioned this in his speeches. So that's what earlier, Bruce, you were talking about. Does Kamaluddin his point here?
Well, like I said, I think that's one of the scary things about this is, you know, Putin has said it, you know, it was one of the biggest disasters of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, now he's It appears like he's trying to reincorporate Ukraine into a greater Russia, or at least have install his own government that's very favorable to the Kremlin. You know, you can imagine the Baltic states, of course, and you've seen this too on social media, that some people in the Baltic states are a little scared about this themselves. But like I said, you know, where does this exactly end? We've had, not only has Putin mentioned that Kazakhstan never had was a state or a nation, you know, but he's even got people in the Duma that have mentioned, you know, within the last 6 or 7 months that, you know, nobody was living in northern Kazakhstan until the Russians came there. All the Kazakhs lived in the south. You know, they have no claim to that land. Of course, in the first 10 years after independence, there were Russians in northern Kazakhstan that thought that they should be part of Russia, not part of Kazakhstan. That was one of the reasons people gave, not officials in Kazakhstan, but one of the reasons they gave for transferring the capital from Almaty to Astana, Nur-Sultan now. You know, it was just to stake a claim to the northern part of Kazakhstan and kind of make clear that, you know, they weren't going to be able to, you know, these separatists in northern Russian separatists in northern Kazakhstan wouldn't be able to take that section away and attach it to Russia in the future. So, like I said, it's something you gotta really think about. Where does this stop exactly? You know, I'd be worried if I was in northern Kazakhstan, but you know, if they do make a move and there's some and claim that the Russian ethnic Russian population is being discriminated against, and of course we know that nationalism is rising in Central Asia, and it doesn't exclude some harsh verbal attacks on Russians living in the country. We just saw the incident at the arcade in Kyrgyzstan last summer, I think, when the Kyrgyz man threw a calculator at a Russian girl who was working there, and it cut, you know, Zhirinovsky was in the Duma denouncing it and screaming about, you know, it's time to either cut Kyrgyzstan off or reincorporate it or something. So, you know, for Putin to sit there, especially the way he delivered that speech too, you know, it's got to give people the creeps. Central Asia wondering if he hasn't totally lost it. Ukraine is first, and you know, where's next after that?
Yeah. No, before Ukraine there was a Georgian scenario that we have seen in terms of South Ossetia. You know, Crimea is also there. And Erica, you might also want to jump in here. One is that Putin is talking about this in the context of Ukraine. What are the real possibilities that this scenario could repeat in Central Asia?
So, like with anything else related to Putin's aggression, I want to be proven wrong in the future. But I think now is the time to start imagining the previously implausible scenarios for Kazakhstan. Just like for Kazakhstan, this is where Ukraine was in 2014 or 2008 when Putin invaded Georgia. So I think if Putin succeeds in creating chaos and staying in power, so creating chaos, he has succeeded in creating chaos in Ukraine. But if he continues to stay in power, Kazakhstan is next. And Kazakhstan, as Bruce just mentioned, has been part of this long-term rhetoric of hate from Putin and his loyalists. From time to time, they stir up the discussion with claims for northern Kazakhstan, not so veiled claims for northern Kazakhstan. So there will be the next stage in recreating the Soviet Union from Moscow's perspective, from Putin's perspective. Kazakhstan seems to be the next logical step because Baltic states are part of NATO, and that's also another direction where Putin can go. But Kazakhstan seems to be a logical step. And we don't know what kind of form it will take, but I think this is the time to start imagining how it can happen. Mm.
That's the references that Putin gave when talking about Ukraine's history. But also, Paul, your background as the diplomat, I think you might be well suited to answer this question. Like now, Putin also declared Luhansk and Donbass region of Ukraine as so-called independent states. So what are the scenario going forward? Could Russia drag the region to follow the suit? And could Russia also involve CIA somehow to support where it stands in terms of those so-called republics?
I think this is very difficult. I think the only person who knows what's in Putin's mind is actually Putin himself, and he probably doesn't even know, you know, what is in Putin's mind. You know, I think if, you know, from the Russian perspective, if their campaign in Ukraine goes well, it seems to be going fairly well so far, although they seem to be getting a little bit more resistance in some places, at least according to the Pentagon reports I've read. If it goes well and it's quick, you know, there might not be need to sort of pull everybody else in. If it also, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, the Russians, and this is an implication for the rest of the region, is basically how this campaign goes. You know, you can take a country fairly easily, as the U.S. learned in Iraq in 2007, but can you govern a hostile country where there's going to be rebellions and rebels? And so we don't know how this is going to play out down the road. I think that gives the region of Central Asia, you know, a little bit of breathing space. I actually think, you know, countries like Moldova might be more in trouble in the short-term future. But I think, you know, these countries, they're going to be in a tough balancing act. You know, none of them are going to want to be pressured into recognizing these entities. They will be pretty much become pariah states to the outside world. It would also cause them problems with China, which is not on board with recognition of these two entities. You know, so my gut is that they will just try to keep their heads low. They'll have to make some difficult decisions at the UN. I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot of abstentions at the UN. But I think, you know, particularly on the recognition front, I think they also could probably hide under China and not pursue that recognition. And I think that's one of the positive things that gives them a little bit of room. And I think they would all be very hesitant to, you know, get involved militarily. I think, you know, the CSTO
Can they afford being hesitant? I mean, Putin, Putin.
I think they will be summoned. We've already seen Azerbaijani leader get summoned to Moscow. Right. I think we'll see a lot of these leaders get summoned to Moscow in a very clear vision that they are not going to help Russia show that they're not isolated. I could certainly see some of these elements, particularly after Kazakhstan, CSTO peacekeepers maybe having to go in. Yeah. That I think would be, there would need to be a scenario that would need to be created for that. Maybe the going into, you know, Eastern parts of Eastern Ukraine. I think, you know, we'll at least see on the diplomatic front, we'll see, you know, lots of shuttling back and forth. But I think all of these states, including the CSTO ones, would resist stepping in right away. I think, you know, they don't want their soldiers. You know, these countries are all authoritarian, but they also have, you know, publics that care about, you know, the young men who would have to go in there. So I think they would be highly resistant, knowing that neither China or the West would want to see them there, and they'd have to be able to balance. But we're definitely going to see a lot of shuttle diplomacy between Moscow and four of the five Central Asian states.
Yeah. I guess, you know, the young Berdimuhamedov in Turkmenistan must be thinking about that he don't have to deal with any of them being a neutral country there. But anyway, Alisher, if you have any thoughts to add in terms of the possible political implications of that going forward, please go ahead and share your, you know, opinions. But in the meantime, I had some economic question to you. I guess the economy is very, very serious economic side of this. It's obvious that sanctions are going to bite Russia and the Russian financial institutions. So in which ways do you anticipate this to affect your country, Uzbekistan, or Central Asia in a broader context?
I believe that Uzbekistan will be economically the most affected at this point, because there are kind of two parts there. First is, Russia is the largest trade partner of Uzbekistan and the largest investor. They have all joint oil and gas projects. Lukoil is there, Gazprom is there, all the, you know, metal explorations and processing companies. So a lot of Uzbek companies are producing products that are meant to be sent to Russia, vegetables, you know, everything, agriculture, chemistry. So if you look from that perspective, you may even say that President Mirziyoyev put all eggs into one basket in terms of economy. Then there's a second big part is migrants, you know, rising dollars rate in Russia makes it impossible to earn enough money and send back to Uzbekistan. So last year, Uzbek labor migrants sent nearly a staggering $8 billion in remittances. It's a very, very big money for Uzbekistan. Yeah, it's more than its exports of everything combined. So the migrants issue will be huge. And then what would be next for these migrants? To return to Uzbekistan and increase unemployment? So it's pretty grim, let's say, prospect on the economic side. So how Uzbekistan will diversify its economy going further, that would be a big question. Yeah. I guess Tajiks may have the same concerns. maybe Kazakhstan, lesser extent, you know, maybe Kyrgyzstan has the same issue, of course. Yeah. So economically falling Russia, if Russia is falling sort of gradually, but here the countries in the Russia's sort of a backyard, they're going down faster.
The kind of same question, like, you know, Paul, I guess this is your area. Please forgive my ignorance when I ask this question. I have no idea how these sanctions work. Western leaders are talking about this severe, unprecedented sanctions that they have in mind. President Biden was talking about the Europeans are also stepping up their sanctions. When a certain institution, bank or any other financial institution is sanctioned, what does that mean? What does that mean for Central Asia? Like, you can't do business with that bank, or what? How does it work?
It's pretty much, you know, most of global transactions are done in dollars. And so, you know, these banks are precluded from both doing transactions both now in dollars and in euros. So it makes it very difficult for these, if they do not want to be in violation, which then can get them sort of kicked out of the doing business with the U.S. financial or European financial system. They have to be very careful in going around. You saw this, if you look at China and how Chinese banks reacted. Many of the Chinese commercial banks actually abided by U.S. sanctions after 2014 against Russia, where it was more of the state banks that were willing to buck them because they had the Chinese state behind them. And I do know in 2014, 2015, there was a lot of issues within the U.S. government of how to carve out ways in which former Soviet states could do financial transactions, basically because the majority of the banks that are in the region are engaged with Russian banks. Right. So there was a lot of, I do know all of ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors in the region were busy cabling back to Washington, highlighting the challenges that these banking sanctions posed, both for, you know, local businesses, but also some, you know, American companies that were trying to get money into or out of the region. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a big complication. I'm sure that the U.S. government is trying to work with these countries to try to figure out avenues around it. And, you know, we'll see where that goes. You know, some of these states, I could imagine, surprisingly, Georgia, I saw today, said that it was not going to abide by some of these new sanctions, basically in an effort to avoid antagonizing the Russians. We'll see whether, you know, some Central Asian states come out and say that. But even if the states come out and say that, there very well might be individual companies within those countries that might actually have different views. So like the Chinese firms, China was not going to abide by the sanctions, but the Chinese commercial banks certainly did.
Okay, that's about the bank. But what about, like earlier, Alisher was talking about Lukoil, the Russian company being active in Uzbekistan, like companies who also fall under these sanctions. How does it affect their activities in some of those countries?
I'm not sure. I'm not a sanctions expert, you know, beyond the beyond the basics. So I'm not sure, you know, how exactly it will impact it. I do know that these are geared far more towards international investment into Russia. But I think, you know, it will make people think twice, make international investors think twice about engaging, you know, with these entities. And I'm, you know, pretty sure that these countries, you know, also may be under pressure from Russia to respond against American investors there as well. So, you know, I think for the investment climate, these sanctions are bad overall. You're going to have more Western countries being wary about investing because of the risks. And then, you know, I think there's going to be and the collateral risks of investing in something that in Kazakhstan that might have a connection. So I think this is really going to be problematic for attracting broader based investment into the region.
Yeah, Rush, Bruce, I was also thinking about the Eurasia Economic Union. That's the kind of Russian-led economic union involving a couple of Central Asian countries there. Whether Russia could play that card in some ways to ease the impact and what that could mean for the member countries. Where is that going to put the member countries?
Well, that's a good question. I'm trying to figure out what exactly they can do. You know, I mean, so far, for instance, you know, for one example, like the Eurasian Economic Union is supposed to make it easier for migrant workers from the member countries to work in Russia. But then we just saw that the Kyrgyz were forced to submit to these medical tests. I think they're monthly or something. They come at their own expense. I mean, they weren't exempted from that, even though they're part of the Eurasian Economic Union. So I'm not really sure what, you know, what they could do. Does Russia have money that they say we can make up the difference on something like this? Well, no, you know, not really. So I don't see the Eurasian Economic Union playing any kind of role that Russia couldn't do, you know, just by itself in bilateral relations, no, which would really have to do because only Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan are Eurasian Economic Union members.
I was just thinking about from a different perspective, like whether Russia could use this in its advantage. As it is isolated, right? When it is isolated, whether Russia could use this as an advantage to make Central Asian countries do something which could ease Russia's, burden?
No, I don't really. You know, this would be tough, you know, both generally speaking of Central Asia as a region, because they trade with all kinds of different people. You can't adopt rules that you want to help you out or hurt certain, you know, the West or something, right? Without having to worry about, you know, China and the Middle East, have to trade with them too. So, you know, you can't, how do you make rules that are going to work for everybody? And for the two member states of the countries, like I said, it's hard for me to imagine that they would agree to something that's not going to be in their own interest. I mean, Kyrgyzstan's already had a real hard time being a member of that organization and have complained a bunch about the fact that it hasn't seemed to make very much of a difference to them at all. Mm. So I don't know what threat Russia has, what leverage it has through that organization that it could say, you better play our game or else, because the response is going to be, we're not getting that much out of it. You know, so why would we do this?
That's what I mean. Whether they can say that to Russia, whether they can say that to Putin, that's what I was wondering on the back of my mind. I mean, when Russia say, okay, you are a member of this, let's work together. I mean,
I have a thought on that, if I can go.
Yeah.
I think the most sort of the coercive power that Russia has in this is probably not through the Eurasian Union. It would be either, I mean, Russia is willing to show its teeth, its coercive teeth, and using its hard military toolkit against Ukraine. Mm. I could certainly see countries in the CSTO coming under more pressure than countries in the Eurasian Economic Union. One thing that I think we have to also remember is that, you know, this will likely give Russia's neighbors in Central Asia and the Central Asian states, you know, a little bit of leverage. If we look back at 2014, all of these countries were really very nervous, kept their heads down for the first few months, and then got a little bit bolder. And the Eurasian Union's, the final negotiations on establishing the Eurasian Union, were in the spring 2014, after Russia had illegally annexed Crimea.
Yeah.
And so you did see Nazarbayev, and you actually saw Lukashenko at that point, really pushing back and trying to get the best deal in the Eurasian Union, effectively stripping out a lot of the political commitments that it would have. And so it is a pretty hollow union. It's a pretty hollow document that is in there. And I could also see, you know, particularly if this gambit in Ukraine does not go well for Russia, and that becomes clear, as it became clear, you know, 2 months after Crimea, you know, I could see some of these countries being a little bit bolder. Right now, they're going to be very cautious, but particularly on the Eurasian Union, I don't see it playing all that role. Mm-hmm. The CSTO, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, these countries are possibly will get some leverage out of this, too.
Other than Russia, other than the Russia connection, I mean, these things also have implications locally to some of those Central Asian countries. Like you brought up, Paul, the story with the illegal annexation of Crimea. You know, following that, for example, speaking of Kazakhstan, tenge was really losing value. And the cost of keeping it stable for Kazakhstan was, during 2014 and 15, $28 billion. And Kazakhstan was doing that because I guess that was an election year for Nazarbayev, and Nazarbayev felt to do something like that. But it's a huge, huge cost. Not all Central Asian countries can afford that. So this local kind of implication, Erika, where do you see these sort of local implication popping up, aside from the Russian connection of Central Asian economy?
So, yeah, it is hard to say. But of course, any economic decline or stagnation will further fuel grievances across Central Asia. And, you know, grievances that nothing to do with Russia, but are more domestic and against local governments or national governments. Yeah, it's not helpful, of course. I think it's a dual economic impact, right? One is what will happen to migrant remittances, given that ruble and other currencies, the regional currencies, are devaluing, and also what will happen domestically on the local level, given that Russian economy will likely also see some decline. So this is a kind of double-edged sort in terms of what not double-edged sword, but the two-level economic impact on Central Asia. And some countries will be able to I think whether it's a little better than others, I think countries that have more labor migrants in Russia will actually likely to be able to weather it better, because labor remittances, no matter economic situation in both sending and recipient countries, they tend to stabilize the economic situation in recipient countries during crises.
Yeah, for that, they need to have a plan. In the meantime, also, we need to wrap up the conversation very short. So what kind of plan are they thinking about? Alisher, do you have any thoughts into it? Yeah, Mirziyoyev said what he said in during his visit to Karakal, Pakistan. But, you know, these possible implications on the political, on the economic level that we are talking about, which is imminent, which is going to come on their way. What kind of contingency plan that they are preparing for this?
I don't think they like have a plan at this point. They're just many just horrified, and they're afraid. They don't know how it's gonna play out for Putin. There are many question marks at this point. Maybe Ukraine is a Putin's political grave. Maybe not. Maybe he will come victorious and get even more powerful and be very explicit while talking to presidents of post-Soviet republics. Maybe he will be just openly putting his demands forward. Maybe he will become softer. We don't know. But in the short term, what we are seeing, that of course it is a kind of a signal to all these republics that Russia is toxic. So, and being with Russia, you're gonna get in trouble too. So you'll keep Russia at certain distance, as they always do. Keep some kind of neutrality. Don't go into these NATO things, or don't get there too much. It's interesting because geographically, Central Asian countries, for example, they are blocked by Russia. So they don't have way further, towards west. It's only Russia. So they cannot go back to China. They're afraid of China. They don't go to Afghanistan or Pakistan or India or Iran. So that's a completely different world for them. Yeah. So that's why they will try to diversify economy. That's going to be number one. Yeah. Logically, it would be a good time to think how to not rely on migrant remittances, how to expand your trade partners, though it will be very hard in the short terms. Maybe in the long terms, many will have to make decisions. Yeah. It's the same for Europe. I mean, even here, Europe is now thinking about its dependency on Russian energy. In Central Asia, they reviewing their dependence on Russia's financial markets, on their banks, on their partnership.
This should be a wake up call for Central Asia and also for Europe. But in Central Asia's case, to Alisher, how you really take those kind of steps in terms of expanding your partners, trade relations, and or maybe political relations with those who really matters? I mean, earlier you said Russia is a toxic. You need to get away from it. Yes, but when you're trying to get away from it, then we have seen in the case of Ukraine, Georgia, maybe in some ways in Armenia, when you take certain steps that Russia don't like, you end up being the target. And especially this time, I mean, how the region would really reach out to the West with a proposal of expanding ties when Russia is under sanction by those powers? It's going to drive Putin nuts. I guess we are walking in the field of lots of unknowns as we speak. We don't know how the Ukraine crisis is going to shape up, what will be the short and long-term implications of this for Russia and for Putin, and based on that, what and how Central Asia is going to react to the reality at hand. I guess we will have to wait and see where we go next from here on so many levels. So let's end the conversation on that note. So where you will be looking at to determine where things might be headed in how it might relate to Central Asia. I'm going to ask brief comments from each of you on that question. So let's start with you, Paul.
Well, I think, what's important is we really don't know. I mean, this is playing out in real time, and it's a tragedy for the entire region. And I think a lot of it will depend on how, what plays out in Ukraine, both in the immediate brutal assault against the country, but also it certainly looks like Putin is going to, try to fully occupy the country. What happens with that occupation? I think the countries are going to, try to lay low, try to reach out to China. China, the United States quietly. But, you know, the United States has for the most part disengaged from the region. So they don't have all that many options. But I think, you know, for at least the short term, they're going to be quiet, going to be, you know, trying to shore up in various ways public images of their sovereignty, and just hope that Russia doesn't turn its sort of brutal attention back to them.
Erika, where your eyes are going to be going forward in terms of what comes next, and how Central Asia also navigate this thing?
Yeah, it's tough for Central Asia to navigate this. I think my eyes would be mostly on the rhetoric coming from Kremlin, and not just from Putin, but also from Russian ambassadors in Central Asia who from time to time engage in really aggressive rhetoric as well in the region about what kind of foreign policy Central Asian countries should be adhering to. And I'll be looking at how Kremlin is trying to limit foreign policy choices for Central Asia and at the same time supporting their loyalists, trying to engage their loyalists in Central Asia. Again, like, for instance, the son of Rahmon in Tajikistan. Yeah, and various pro-Russia forces across Central Asia as well.
Okay, that's a very interesting point you raised, but we have to conclude the conversation. So, Alisher and Bruce, so where you will be watching? Alisher?
I really don't know, really, you know. And I thought about China's role, you know, what China will try to offer at this moment. I thought about maybe, you know, Central Asian countries can be united, sort of a force. That's also very difficult. I think we will be just near Russia all the time, doomed, and slowly going down with it, and when it goes up, going up with it. So it's the, you know, the gravity of Russia is too strong there, and in all spheres. So that's why that's going to be too very difficult to do anything and to look into very specific. We see how countries like Ukraine, Georgia ended up eventually when they tried to cut their ties or to loosen this gravity.
That's very interesting. And Bruce, all the interesting questions come up at the end of our conversation, I know it. But this Russia being isolated, being toxic, as Alisher put it earlier, I guess this also kind of open up opportunities for other countries where they can benefit from and come into Central Asia. China is already there. But anyway, I don't like to expand the conversation. So where your eyes are going to be?
Eyes are going to be on Turkey.
Actually,
you know, Turkey's already been up in its game in Central Asia. This it does have something of a trade route through the Caucasus that connects with Central Asia. And let's face it, what's going on affects the balance of power on the Black Sea. This would be a brilliant time for Turkey to step up and really push more engagement with the at least the Turkic-speaking states of Central Asia, just to counter Russia's moves in Ukraine and to, you know, give the Kremlin something else to think about besides just Ukraine at the moment. So I'm going to be looking and seeing what Erdogan and Ankara do in the coming weeks and months.
Very interesting. Yeah, they just launched this empowered Turkic consul, Ivan Berdimuhamedov, who was their first time attending the meeting in Istanbul a couple of months ago. Anyway, okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So we all will be looking at where, first of all, where things go with Ukraine, what Vladimir Putin ends up doing with Ukraine, with its future. You know, there are lots of questions, but we will keep our eyes on all of them. So with that, thank you very much, Dr. Paul Strunsky, Senior Fellow in Carnegie Endowment's Russia and Eurasia Program, Dr. Erika Marat, Associate Professor at the National Defense University, Alisher Siddiq, the Director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek Service, and Bruce Panier, the Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Media Manager here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.